Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 345th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. And today, James, I think we're going to jump into an area. I was going to say dive. We're going to jump into an area where we don't generally tread.
No. We just do not want to.
So because we know almost nothing about it, some would say nothing at all, we have invited someone on the podcast. So please join me in welcoming Adrian Lindblad. Adrian,
Hi.
You want to introduce yourself? That was great. You wouldn't have guessed it, but Adrian is a PharmD. She's a regular part of our team out here in Edmonton. So Adrian has been working with me for 4 years now, Adrian?
Yeah, it feels like forever, but something like that, yes. Almost 4 years.
Good. Thanks for that. Thanks for that feedback.
Can you feel the love?
It is a love fest.
But you're going to talk today about drugs and pregnancy.
I am. Yes, everybody's favorite topic, the topic everybody's really too scared to ever talk about.
Yeah, and partly because it is such a tricky topic, right? Because, you know, the potential consequences are obviously not good, and the evidence is tricky. And so that's why Mike and I can't deal with it, so we brought you in.
And I would actually like to point out that this topic was, again, a gift to me from Mike.
Yeah.
He suggested I do it. So I again, thank him for giving me this beautiful, easy-to-digest topic.
Yeah, this nice little bundle.
Yes, bundle of joy.
So what do you
think? I have a habit of doing that to everyone on the team. Adrian, why don't you – this is a terrible topic. I don't want to go anywhere near it. Why don't you handle this one? And Tina, I hate this topic. Tina, you're going to handle that one.
Well, you don't quite phrase it like that. It's more, hey, you know what would be great?
Yeah.
I'm going to go into it. It's wonderful.
So anyway, why don't we get into the meat of the business, so to speak?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, this is great. I mean, this is one of those topics that everyone hates because everyone is just so scared of it. And I thought we could kind of just set the stage a little bit by talking a little bit about how much of an issue it is. So there's been some interesting research looking at what the actual baseline risk of malformations is with pregnancy, because safety is always everyone's biggest concern. And the FDA actually has a really interesting document that they've made. It's a guidance for reviewers on how to look at information in pregnancy. And they give some kind of good background information, like about 4% of babies are born with major congenital birth defects every year. And what's really interesting is there's been a number of research looking at this and looking at what do women think of this risk and how big of a risk do they think having a child with malformations is. And there was one study that was an internet-based study that found about 19% of North American women thought that the risk of having a child with birth defects was over 10%. Right. Which is really
high. And it's important because, I mean, it's that sort of baseline belief, and we've talked about this for many other conditions, is we have to sort of set the stage properly. And you know, it was interesting because when you said 4%, it was my belief that it was like 1% to 2%. But that's, it's good to set that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. And then there was a study from the European Journal of Clinical Pharmacology just last year that found in Norway about 63% of women who were on sick leave for nausea and vomiting of pregnancy actually didn't try any medicines for nausea and vomiting before they started their leave. And we don't know why this is, if this was because they were too scared of using it, or was it something where their provider didn't offer them anything? But I thought that was quite a significant number of women who weren't even trying anything for it. The FDA also said that chemically induced birth defects, including ones that are from drug exposure, probably account for less than 1% of all birth defects. So it's something we're so scared of, but it's just maybe not quite as common as we think. And there's probably only about 20 drugs or groups of drugs that are actually recognized as being teratogenic when used in clinical relevant doses in humans.
And I think the perspective is that and we'll probably get into this, is that the problem is if you got this baseline 4% of congenital birth defects, almost everyone, you know, if any mother takes any drug, whether it's even with that group of 20 or not, they will for some reason, go in the head. I wonder if it was that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest issue about how to deal with it. And, you know, almost for sure it wasn't that, but that's the concern that people have when they take medications.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the problems with the type of research for drugs in pregnancy with safety is the issue of recall bias. And women who have had a child with a malformation born, they seem to remember everything they ever took at any time and are really able to remember and say, yes, I did take that medication or whatever at that time. Whereas women who didn't might just not, who didn't have a child with a malformation, just might not remember what they took.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it's months to years later, they really have no idea. If you think about patients, generally don't know what medications they're on half the time anyway. It's really difficult then to say after a child is a year old to go back and say, do you remember what you were taking when you were really nauseous and puking all the time and really tired back in that first trimester of pregnancy? And it's very difficult for people to remember. So that's just one of the big limitations with this kind of research. Another is the idea of the predisposition bias. And is there something about women who are nausea and vomiting who may be predisposed to taking certain medicines, or is the nausea and vomiting itself related to something that could affect the risk of having a child with a birth defect? And so there's all kinds of questions like that. This is just basically limitations of all kinds of cohort studies. It's just they all seem to come to a head when we're talking about drugs and pregnancy.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, when we're looking at this stuff, it's really the entire evidence base is going to be cohort data, really, because you know, you can't really do randomized controlled trials of, you'd have to study literally thousands of people to look for birth defects if there is if you're going to pick it up with an RCT. So it's going to be all cohort data, and that's the problem with all of these biases.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And there are RCT data looking at efficacy of some of these drugs. So
totally.
When you look at them, you know, they take them for like a week, and they'll follow up for like a week. So yeah, there's just not the long-term follow-up that we need for that. The other issue is the concept of detection bias, which is where women who are taking this medication or who have various complications or whatever it might be in pregnancy are more likely to see healthcare professionals more often, maybe have more tests done. So there was actually a very interesting study that showed that women who were on SSRIs actually had, there was a 30% increase in ultrasounds for women who were taking SSRI medication. So as you can imagine, the more ultrasounds you're going to do, the more likely you're going to find stuff. Stuff that might not be clinically relevant, might not be significant, but you are going to find stuff on ultrasounds. And with all these being cohort studies, you really don't know what that risk is or what kind of a clinical impact it could have. So, for example, if they find some kind of a septal defect in the heart, we have no idea how severe it is. We have no idea if it's something that's going to naturally close on its own, since so many of them do. We don't get that information. We're just aware that there might be a septal problem there. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, no, and it is tricky, you know, because you've got all of these, you know, you're going to have, we've talked a lot about in previous podcasts, but all of the false positives and false negatives and all of that sort of stuff. And that's, and it just, this sort of data just feeds that sort of process.
Yeah.
You know, if you start doing 30% more tests, you will find issues, and then, like you said, then you get all back to the recall bias that we talked about and predisposition bias and all that sort of stuff again. So it is tricky. I mean, Mike, you must these conversations must go on a fairly regular basis. I'm not sure you do a lot of maternity stuff, but it's got to be, you know, these discussions come up a lot.
Yeah, we take care of people usually. I don't deliver anymore, but I do take care of people up to 20 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely a little bit longer if they're not being seen soon. But yeah, we have lots of the trouble. Everyone wants an absolutely perfect, flawless outcome. And I totally get that because I had kids and I wanted that too. Who doesn't? But then it leads to this idea that we'll do more tests and can I have another ultrasound, and not everyone's like that, but they do, and certainly taking medicines is very worrisome for patients and in regards to their kids, so they end up wanting more tests and to be extra safe and those kind of things. Although I am surprised too that there's the other side. There's a fair number of women out there who, for example, with early screening, will decline a lot of it because they don't want to mess with nature. And they think too much medicine is too much, or too much intervention is too much. So you know, or much any intervention is too much. So there is a wide range of people out there, but certainly a lot that are very worried, and then we go hunting too often, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. Very true. And so another problem with these, of course, is just the sample size is often inadequate. So if you're doing a case control study, for example, they'll kind of go hunting and looking for problems with malformations and birth defects and just hoping to find some kind of a relationship. But quite often the sample size is just too small to really find anything. And sometimes you'll end up saying something is safe when it might not be. And how do you err on that side of caution? And kind of the last part about these biases is just that data on spontaneous abortions is very rare. It's often not included in various databases or papers that are looked at. The other issue that comes up is just with regards to long-term cognitive effects, because those are very difficult to assess in an infant or a small child. And so looking at things like school readiness and stuff, there's been some concern that this is something that should be looked at, but it almost never is. So, yeah.
And then when we're doing this, I mean, and then one of the most common areas that we have in this is of when, you know, people will take medications is the whole nausea and vomiting around pregnancy. Because if there's any area that it gets so frustrating and people just eventually, you know, lose the will to live, if you will, and want to do something, you know, it's that area. And that's, you know, it is very, very tricky.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And speaking of that, it's so tricky just to assess what outcome you should look at in a nausea and vomiting study. So how do you measure nausea is a really good example. So do you look at number of episodes of nausea per day? That's really tricky because someone will just say, I want to puke all day long. It's like one big 24-hour loop of nausea. So when right. we get into some of these other issues, just trying to determine what an appropriate outcome is tricky, I guess you could say.
And very, you know, similar to a lot of the sort of symptomatic studies that you see with, you know, not, you know, whether it be pain, is it, you know, when we talk about pain, is that 24 hours a day pain? Or is it just, you know, during the morning? Is it just when you're going for a walk with osteoarthritis and so on? And like you said, that's where it gets tricky. And hopefully that they look at a variety of different outcomes, like the number of vomit, how often they vomit, how long it goes on, but there is a fair amount of data that's looked at this. I'm not saying we're going to have a really clear answer, but there are studies.
Absolutely, there are, and they've all measured things in different ways. And we'll talk about all this fun stuff that's there. I thought maybe we could start with Cyclectin, because that's the study that has been in the media the most recently. And I'm sure you guys saw that back in end of December, early January, the news was talking about how there's this new evidence that Cyclectin doesn't work and women are all worried about it now because it's not working and blah, 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 blah. So I was already looking into this.
And that's what they said?
Yeah, she did say blah, blah, blah.
They
said blah, blah. And that is a direct quote. Yes, every article said blah, blah, blah. I know. It was fascinating.
Yeah. And
fake news.
Yeah. And Cyclectin is like many of the stories that you hear. It's kind of like butter is bad for you, then it's good for you, then it's bad for you, then it's good for you. And this is the same thing with this treatment, is that it gets a life of its own every few years when people look at things.
Absolutely. So, I mean, a number of years ago in the States, it had actually been taken off the market. And the reason for that had nothing to do with the efficacy or the safety of the drug. It had to do with lawsuits against the drug manufacturer. There had been some concerns that it was causing birth defects. But the evidence didn't support that. It was just that the manufacturer said that they couldn't afford to keep manufacturing the drug with all of these lawsuits coming on. And the Americans went for years without this medication for reasons that I think are absolutely fascinating.
Right, especially, you'd have thought it would have to do with efficacy and toxicity, but it's not, especially in this area, it's not always the case.
Exactly, and again, we're calling it Cyclectin. We probably shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. It's doxylamine and pyridoxine, which has got different names no matter where you go in the world, different combinations, Bendectin and all kinds of things. I was already looking at this when this kind of came out, and I had really been focused on safety, and I was focused on safety because that just seems to be the thing everybody is most concerned about, or used to be anyway, when they were talking about this. And there's been a lot of research actually into the safety of doxylamine and pyridoxine. We've actually got at least 5 systematic reviews looking at the safety of antihistamines, including doxylamine, up to about 37 observational studies, up to 50,000 women who were exposed to the drug. And really, although there's been concerns that some of these have been industry-funded and had industry connections in them, they've all been fairly consistent in saying that there's no risk of fetal malformations with doxylamine. Probably the one study that didn't seem to have any financial ties anywhere had an odds ratio of 0.94 with a confidence interval of 0.8 to 1.1.
Yeah, so you mean not even really a suggestion of anything, although it gets tricky with all of these confidence intervals and point estimates.
Absolutely.
And so on, but it's certainly not, if this is the way to look at the information, this would not be a signal of going, uh-oh, we better look at something.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the first meta-analyses that looked at this, which has been subsequently quite criticized, but at the time they actually, I can't remember what the odds ratio was that they found, but they actually found that use of this medication was protective against malformations, and they found it was statistically significant. So that was actually very interesting, that for a long time people were thinking maybe this medication can prevent birth defects, but that study had some significant limitations. It had, for example, it was a systematic review. It included a study of Haldol, a review article on Haldol. A lot of the references weren't easy to match up with what they actually were and pulling up the correct numbers and things like that. So a different group ended up redoing that study and found that, no, it wasn't protective, but it definitely didn't cause a risk either.
Yeah, and I think we have to be very careful to say that, you know, these are all cohort trials and none of them will ever tell us whether it is, you know, protective or not protective, if you know what I mean. It really is just a suggestion. It's sort of but it's really the only information that we're going to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the best we're going to have. And everything, though, has been very consistent, which is really nice to see, especially with cohort data, showing that everything is very consistent, that there doesn't seem to be a problem. So I think that's nice to see, because we'll talk about some other stuff where we don't have that consistency. So, yeah. So there's also this questionable history or issue of childhood cancers with this medication. And this comes up surprisingly often in a lot of reviewer papers that you'll read about Diclectin or medications for nausea and vomiting. And it's really based on 2 studies from, I believe it was the late 1980s, that were case control studies. And they were kind of fishing expeditions looking for potential issues with Diclectin or looking for potential issues or potential causes of some types of childhood cancers. And overall, one of the studies found that there was an increased risk of childhood cancers for women's offspring who had taken Diclectin. It was a relative risk of about 1.75. This did increase to 2.8 when the use was longer than 10 weeks. The problem is there was no consistency in terms of what types of childhood cancers these were and when they occurred. One of the other studies divided up risk depending on if the mother could remember using the Diclectin or if the medical provider reported use of Diclectin. And if they went by what the mother said she took, there was no risk at all of childhood cancers. But if they went with what the physician said the patient took, there was a relative risk of about 10, with longer-term use being greater than 1 to 2 months.
Yeah. I mean, I always like it when the evidence makes you happy.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And we looked at which ones had cats and didn't have cats compared to the astrological sign. And then we examined, oh my God. So, you know, James indicated just a moment ago that because these are cohort studies, we can't show causation. We need actually randomized trials to show causation. But one of the things you can do is kind of, there are rules of causation within observational data where you look for a consistency in a pattern so that the same thing keeps being seen over and over again. There's a biologic mechanism for what's happening. There's a the effect is large and repeatable. So we're not seeing a larger repeatable effect, but we do in one of these arms see a large effect, 10 times increase. So that's kind of the thing that makes you go, okay, there's a chance that could be real. But then we look at, if there's a dip where you're moving from a 10 times risk to no difference at all, just based on who reports whether a product was used or not, I think it takes a lot away from the validity of these findings.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the number of 10 that I mentioned before, so the confidence interval, that was 1.76 to 57.
Yeah. And so
nice and tight. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
But that's really all we have on childhood cancer then?
Yep, that is what we have.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's... Yeah. You know, just very exploratory, and you know, and we may never know the answer to that. But that, you know, when you have that, you know, people who are not in favor of using these medications, they'll bring up the tenfold. The other people will bring up the other one. It gets very tricky.
But, I mean, absolutely, James, totally right. They will pick what they. It's the old Simon and Garfunkel, right? A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. So,
I love the fact that you brought music into it.
I know you do. I know you do. And I know also that you know the answer to all these questions, but you're not spilling the beans.
No, no. I'm just keeping it to myself, but for a small payment. So that's the data on, you know, the sort of potential for harm, at least the harm of things like fetal malformations and cancer and stuff, which we will only ever be able to look at through, sort of cohort trials. But I guess the key thing is, that does it even... do anything? Because if it doesn't work, is there any point in using it? So there is a fair amount that we have better information on that.
Absolutely, we do. So we actually have four systematic reviews that have looked at a number of different medications for nausea and vomiting. But I'm not really going to talk about them too much when we're talking about this medication, because this is the one where they just published that study at the end of December, early January, that is not included in those systematic reviews. So this was interesting. This was a paper they published in PLOS, and it was through the I can't remember what it's called, the RATE initiative. I don't know if you can remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was basically a group of researchers went and wanted to publish a study that had previously not been reported. And this was a study done in the 1970s that the FDA had on file, Health Canada had on file, and had frequently been quoted by various sources as, this is the evidence that Diclectin works. But of course, it had never been published, so most of us really had no idea what was in it. So this study was about 2,300 women, and there was 8 different arms to it. So you could be randomized to doxylamine alone, pyridoxine alone, dicyclamine alone, or in various combinations, or placebo for 7 days.
Okay, and on the front of it, that is just a trial that I would love, because it answers, you know, it's got, you know, 2,500 patients in them, and they're looking at all of the different combinations. It's exactly the study that kind of you would want to do, even though, you know, people go, well, it's got 8 arms to it, so it must be sort of a, kind of a crazy study. But those are really important answers. And in fact, if it was well done, with that number of people and all, you could actually... you know, study the effectiveness of these medications in alone or in combination.
Absolutely. James, it should be like our dream study. Sorry, Mike, go ahead.
But we don't need the information to be published, though, do we?
Oh, of course not. No, we like it not to be published, so we have no idea what's going on. but you know, and it's interesting that, because there are a few other examples of where people have gone back in time to look at the data that was there in a variety of things. And, you know, we have to give a little bit of latitude to, you know, back in the 1970s, all you have to do is look at the clothes that people were wearing back then and realize it was a troubled time.
And the music.
Yeah, it was a troubled time. but nonetheless, it's really useful, because this may be the best data that we have, or at least some very useful data. So what do they actually find?
Yeah, so... Well, it's interesting. It was very difficult for the researchers to go and actually get much out of this information. This was considered interim trial data. It's not even final trial data. People were still recruiting into the study when they had these interim results published. But, of course, this is what we have. The rest of the results just don't seem to be in existence. Mm-hmm. And they tried contacting the original authors. Some of them had passed away. So they really had to deal with what the information that they had there was. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating paper to read. But basically what they found is, if they looked at doxylamine B6 compared to placebo, they found, first of all, that it improved overall medication efficacy. And this was about 78% versus 57% in the placebo group. Now, unfortunately, I don't know what efficacy or effectiveness means. They didn't know what it meant either. That's just how it was listed in the original report. So take that for whatever that means. They also found that nausea improved 75% versus 52%. Vomiting did not improve, not statistically anyway.
Right.
But patients overall rated doxylamine B6 on better on nausea and vomiting than placebo. So that was kind of the gist of it.
So that's the evidence that was used to say that this drug works for many, many years.
Yes. Yeah, that was it. Only about 66% of people actually completed this 7-day study. So there's a lot of information missing. There's some questions. I'm trying to be as polite as I can.
a third of people are missing after 7 days. Wow, yeah. That is...
it's impressive, isn't it? Yep.
And
there's some very questionable data integrity as well. So there was at least one researcher who there was concerns that they were recording information in the absence of patient visits. So maybe not seeing patients, but having outcomes for them.
So you're supposed to have the patients there when you report,
when you make an assessment
how
of them.
They're doing.
Yeah.
When you
I believe that's how it should be done. I think that that
is
would
that
be
also
helpful.
True for billing when you're doing your billings at the end of the week. I don't
but,
just
that
taking
might be
notes
preferred.
Here, Adrian.
Yeah,
I'm taking,
absolutely.
I'm taking a lot.
But it's I mean, you know, like I said, but you know, it was a bit of the, you know, the wild, wild west when these studies were all being done, and it you know, and some of this data may have been collected, but if you can't get access to it, it's hard to know what to do with it. But yeah,
and
this sort of it's a great example of showing, you know, how far we've actually come when it comes to looking at clinical trials, because you know, this was RCTs relatively in their infancy, trying to figure out all of this. And certainly, you know, when you have a third of people who don't complete a study, that is of issue. Now, when you see big effects, it's not so much of a deal when you know, losing a third period is a pretty big number. But, you know, when you have a, it does seem kind of odd that you lose that many people over a 1 week period or whatever time period it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And there, like you said, I mean, in the 70s, stuff was done a little differently. So what were the outcomes? Were they prospectively specified? And that information is not available.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some concern there may have been selective reporting. We just don't know because the information's not there. You can go on and on with this paper. A lot of the denominators were missing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't necessarily confirm math for a lot of the math and stuff was done. It's
right.
Just, it's quite fascinating.
So what you're looking at from an effectiveness, if you look just looking at the numbers, it's about a 20% absolute improvement in things like the overall effectiveness and nausea and so on.
And nausea, yeah. Not vomiting.
Yeah, but you've really got to take that with a grain of salt. And then there were also some, in quotation marks, harms as well, right?
Yeah, there was. So, but again, not well reported. So drowsiness, for example, was there. It was about 5.6% versus 3%. That gives you a number needed to harm of about 38, which to me I thought seemed quite high from what I've heard of people who've complained about doxylamine causing drowsiness. But
but virtually every, you know, not every antihistamine, but many antihistamines do cause sedation. So I'm not surprised that you would see that. And in fact, it's maybe one of the reasons why it actually does anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we can't use that as that, you know, this is not the best evidence to look at harm because it wasn't the best evidence to look at effectiveness, but that's at least what this study did show.
Yeah. But and as you said before, I mean, this is what we have and this is what we have to go on. One of the only other RCTs that we have is an industry-sponsored RCT of about 259 women. This one was more recent. This one was at least in, I believe it was the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
They found about a 1-point decrease in a 15-point nausea and vomiting scale at day 15. So that's sort of what they have there. They also found about a 1-point improvement on a 10-point quality of life scale. And then in the subsequent publication, they went through the individual nausea, vomiting, and retching scores and found no change in any of those scores over placebo.
And typically, when we look at sort of 10-point global assessments, and I can't speak for this one in particular, Mike, but I, you know, a 1-point change in a 10-point scale usually is on the border of what we would consider a minimally clinically important difference, and that I'm not saying that's for this one because that would have to be assessed, but you know, it at least with a slightly better done trial, it showed at least it did something of some value.
Yeah, this is usually the kind of cutoff that you would expect to be clinically meaningful in a rough sense. We see them ranging anywhere from kind of a 0.9, 0.8 to a 1.3 range, and we don't have the baseline information here, but it's often somewhere around 5 when people are enrolled in these type of trials, and they get to around 2.8 versus 1.8, so 3 versus 2. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of in keeping with a reasonable benefit. We don't know the number who had a 30% improvement or reached the clinically meaningful point, but this is a classic example of how trials are reported. They're not generally reported very well for these kind of scale outcomes, and it boggles my mind. It's almost like the people who are doing these studies and writing them up have never actually tried to get data from studies.
Yeah, no, I totally, and you know, because you could get all of that information. You could even if you went back and retrospectively said, you know, how many people got a 30% change and all that, and it would just help to. And it would help people like us who do sort of the knowledge translation to put it into perspective. But you're right. There's often a disconnect between what researchers are looking for and then how they present the results. And it's unfortunate. And then when it comes into this area, you know, again, in defense of this area, these are tricky studies to get done because there are ethical dilemmas. There are, you know, not everybody who's pregnant would want to be enrolled in clinical trials like this. So these are difficult studies to do even at the best times, which explains why we don't have a lot of these studies, even though the answers are really, really important. So are there really no other studies than these two, or is there some other stuff that's available?
There's really two other studies that are quite a bit older, from like 1960s, early 1970s as well, but there's a lot of information missing from them as well. I don't feel that they really add to our understanding of diclectin. One found no difference compared to placebo, and the other found fewer patients with no improvement compared to placebo. But like I said, there's the information there is lacking, so I don't think it really helps our discussion here today.
Yeah. So we were basically limited to the very, very large trial that was just sort of reported in the last few months, and then you know, a couple of industry funded trials that are suggestive somewhat on some endpoints. So that, you know, I don't know what you guys do or Mike. I mean, when you see this information, where do you see this? Where do you guys recommend this treatment? Like, or is this something? Is this a go to for you guys?
Well, yeah. So we're going to talk about some of the other medicines.
Yeah, we'll do that in the next podcast.
So I would offer, for most women, it depends on what they want, but I would talk about, you know, first of all, when they complain about nausea and vomiting, or when we ask about it at the visit and they bring it up, then I ask, are you able to eat, and what have they done to modify their diets to eat small meals more frequently and small amounts and bland foods and all of those kind of things. And when is it worse? So then if it's, you know, morning entirely, then what about eating in the evening? Oh, I can do that. So, you know, then we avoid a lot of the medicine talk. When we get to the medicine talk, then we're talking about how to manage it. We often give diclectin in the evening, like at bedtime kind of thing, to prevent in the morning them feeling sick. But we offer them options like B6, just pyridoxine alone. We'll talk about that later. We offer options like some women are like, I'm not going to take any medicines. Then we talk about things like ginger. Or often, I rarely ever bring something like ginger up, but if they bring it up, then we talk about that one. But I certainly prescribe diclectin when women are interested in an intervention. I'm trying to switch more to pyridoxine based on, we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. There's really not much difference when you're talking about adverse events and all this. I don't buy the cancer thing. I don't think that that's likely real. It would need a lot more support for me. But I'll offer them either one of those two to start with, and then see how it goes. And you gradually titrate up. And nausea and vomiting frequently has a window, which it's a problem in the pregnancy. So often by the time they've seen me, then we get them on a medicine and we start titrating it up.
they're starting to within a, you know, two to four weeks they're starting to not need it anymore anyhow.
Yeah. And then you get all of these observational things. Yeah, as soon as, you know, I took it and it seemed to work, and that's
for sure. It's such a tricky area. There's a ton of that happening, and there's a placebo effect that has multiple components to it. Mm-hmm. As you indicated, just the timing, or you led on from my comment about the timing. There's also, there probably is a bit of a true placebo effect here. That's probably even smaller than the timing. Mm-hmm. But there's a bunch of things going on. So I rarely have people doing a lot of refills of Diclectin. It does happen. But I think women are very concerned about harms in pregnancy, so they minimize the amount of products that they take. Although I, mm-hmm. from what Adrian reviewed, I'm not too concerned about Diclectin's harms. I don't think, as you indicated, with the confidence intervals where they are, it's highly improbable that something real is happening there.
Yeah, and I was going to say, the lack of refills is certainly suggestive of when this stuff does go away, but it may be also reflective of it doesn't do much.
Yeah. I think that some patients will tell you that it's not working very well. Others swear by it. And, only God knows if specifically for that individual whether it really is the drug, its timing, whatever. Yeah. I think there are people who probably benefit from it, just like there are people who really benefit from, let's say, ranitidine over PPIs. Mm-hmm. So it does happen.
Like the tricky part about this is you know, when in all of these studies, when you're looking at like the number of people who benefit in the placebo group, or at least seem to get a benefit, you will have lots of people swearing that it works, and it is probably just the natural fluctuation of the condition, and so that's where it gets tricky. But anyway, so this is as much information that we do have with this product, and there's not much else we can talk about. So why don't we just we'll leave it at that for now, and then we'll get into in the next podcast. We'll talk about some of the other things like B6 ginger on Dancitron, and some of the other products that may be that at least have some level of evidence. And
or you think they do?
yeah. I'm not saying I'm not. This is not an advertisement for any of those products. We'll just sort of go over the evidence as we can. So I don't think we have a whole lot of stuff to sell, at least no Diclectin anyway. And so if you guys want to check out all the stuff that we do on our website, there's lots of tools for practice coming out. So please check that out as these wonderful guys push all this information out to you guys. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.